It is 2 o'clock and time for your appointment with the Reluctant Therapist. But before I ask you, Elizabeth, what's on your mind, I understand you're celebrating the beginning of your 18th year on KCBX. Congratulations.
Thank you.
That is so impressive.
Thank you.
So before you jump into the show, I have a question.
Okay.
How did you become the Reluctant Therapist?
Well, the Reluctant Therapist part actually is predated by many years with my radio experience that started when I was 16. I was doing play-by-play announcing in my high school. And this story is a little weird because I don't really remember the whole genesis of it, but I just know that a man approached me and asked me if I wanted to do play-by-play for a high school, a station that was covering all high school sports. And I said yes, and I did that. But I don't remember a lot of the details of it, but that was kind of my first taste of radio, and I loved it, and went to UC Santa Barbara as a communications major, and I was assuming I would be a sportscaster. But at that time, there were no female sportscasters. It was even before Donna DeVerona was a sportscaster. And so I was discouraged by my professors who said, you know, there's probably no room for you in that area, so find other things. And I ended up kind of leaving that behind and getting married. And then I was in the mall in Santa Maria, and I'm just looking around one evening, and they were doing a live remote from the KXFM radio station, and the DJ that was there, I went over and just looked at what they were doing or said hello, and he said, "You have a really good radio voice." And I said, thank you. And he said, "Have you thought of doing radio?" And I just kind of laughed. And anyways, he said, "You know, we always are hiring part-time people if you wanted to come do that." And so I said, "Well, that sounds like fun." I was a stay-at-home mom with a three-year-old, and so I thought that'd be a fun activity, and I went to work with them, working the overnight shifts and then the midday shift, and then started the morning show and did a morning show for a couple of years with my partner, Larry Sanders. And then radio changed dramatically, and they moved away from a lot of the live radio and started doing all the pre-recorded radio, which kind of sad, and our station got sold. And so the timing was kind of nice to retire from radio and kind of focus on being at home raising my daughter. And then I went back and got my master's degree during that time to become a therapist. Mostly that was a personal journey. I never really intended to become a therapist. That wasn't my goal. I just loved the school, Pacifica Graduate Institute. Shout out to my alma mater. I was really fascinated by the whole world of depth psychology and goddess spirituality. I'd gone to Coalesce Bookstore a few times for full moon ceremonies. I'm dating myself with all this, but I was just so fascinated by it. And so I went to Pacifica, loved all of the learning about Jung and mythology and individuation, all these things I'd never thought about before. And then part of your master's program is to do an internship. And so I did an internship in San Luis Obispo at the Child Development Resource Center at the Parent Support Center. And I really loved doing parent work. So I thought, well, that was kind of fun. And so I finished up with my master's degree and just worked part-time. I always worked part-time. I call it my hobby energy. My full-time job is being a wife and a mom, which I always state at the beginning of the show. But my hobby energy was doing this parenting work, in-home parent work, with people here on the Central Coast. And I loved doing that. And I did it for quite a while. And then, of course, as things happen, they were trying to save money in the county. And instead of, you know, cutting back on the administration and all the bigger titled positions that push papers, they got rid of our whole department that was doing in-home counseling for families who were in crisis. And these families, you know, weren't within social services, but they were on the edge. And so there was a whole team of us who were marriage and family therapists and a lot of interns who were doing this work of going in and working with the families to make sure they didn't end up in the social services system. And it was a phenomenal program. It had been around for 20 years by the time I had been a part of it. And they closed the doors, and all of these families were kind of left teetering, which happens quite often in our world of social services. And I looked around and realized, oh, I guess over this course of, you know, the 6 years I've been working for the county, I've earned enough hours to be able to become a licensed therapist. So I took the licensing exam and became licensed, and kind of there I was. And I worked, again, just 10 to 15 hours a week in another program, the Child Development Resource Center, which is the other one that I mentioned. And it was during that time that I found myself sitting in a lot of supervision circles with other clinicians in the county. And every week we'd come together talking about cases. And it became more and more untenable for me because we'd go around the table and almost every single time they'd read a case, usually about young children, because I was working at a resource center for kids or preschool through third grade, I think, at the time. Then they'd read what was happening with a child, and it seemed like every time, if not 90% of the time, we had one psychiatrist who worked with all the county patients, and all he did was write prescriptions for these kids just over and over again for ADHD and for behavior issues. And it just was so overwhelming to just consistently have these children being diagnosed when they weren't being seen by the psychiatrist. They weren't really being seen by anyone except for what the teachers were noticing in classrooms or what the, you know, social workers were seeing. And then they started writing prescriptions for 4-year-olds, 5-year-olds, for bipolar disorder, and putting them on heavy antipsychotic drugs. And I just couldn't do that anymore. It was wrong. I knew the statistics. We know nothing about what happens to children who are put on SSRIs, which are the antidepressants, anti-anxiety. We knew even less about what would happen to these children who were put on these heavy antipsychotic drugs at 3, 4, and 5 years old. We weren't offering the parents any sort of really helpful behavioral work or parenting skill sets to help them work with kids that were challenging. And it was as if no one understood systems therapy, which is centered on the idea that children are just a reflection of the experience they're having in their homes, and that their behaviors are not biologically driven, but driven by reacting to what's happening with their parents or in their schools, right? All of those systems they're involved with. And I would sit in these meetings and think, am I the only one who got that education? Because that would be the primary thing we should be looking at, is how do we help support the families so that they can support their children? But instead, I just watched them write prescription after prescription. And at the same time, Donna, I had a very good friend who went through a horrific breakup and ended up going in for some counseling, and then started this avalanche of services that got out of control. What started with an antidepressant and then another antidepressant and then, you know, different therapists. Because if you're in the system or you rely on insurance or you don't have access to a lot of information, you're just kind of at the whim of whoever's door you walk in and say, hey, I'm depressed, or hey, I'm sad. And over the course of 7 years, I lost this friend. He ended up being on major antipsychotic drugs, ended up having a psychotic break, ended up losing his job and everything. And I, again, felt like I was watching this happen within a system in a profession that I worked in, and it all felt out of control. So that's a long story of the origin. And what happened is that I saw or listened to an NPR. They were doing a contest to try to find the next host for a talk show on NPR. And so I went with a friend, pulled out our old radio files. I said, will you help me make an air check, which they call a demo tape, an air check of this idea I have for a radio show? And so I said yes, and I sent it into NPR, and it went nowhere. But Guy Rathbun, who was at the time the program director here at KCBX, called me and said, I listened to your air check. Would you want to do a show on the air? And I said, yes, that would be great. So I started with these 10 to 12 minute kind of TED Talks every week that were implanted into issues and ideas. And so there was a topic that came through, and I did it once a month. And that took me so long to write out and, you know, have and produce these little 10, 12 minute segments and then record them. It was a labor of love. And I did that for a few years, and Guy left the station, and Marisa came in, and Marisa said, you know, we're not going to do that segment in Issues and Ideas anymore. And I was really sad, but not really sad, because I said, well, that wasn't really my intention anyways when I started. And she said, well, what did you want to do? And I said, I thought I was going to do like a call-in show, like Dr. Laura, but nicer, or Dr. Ruth, but more fun. That's what I kind of was proposing at the beginning. She said, oh, okay, well, would you like to try that? And I said, okay. And so that's how the genesis of the show started. And the very first day that I came in to do my very first hour-long live radio, and Brian Lansone was my producer at the time, my engineer, I walked by Marisa's office and she said, is this going to be any good? And I went, oh no, I thought you thought it would be good. And so, yeah, that was a tough start. But here we are. This is the beginning of the 18th year. And in all truth and transparency, we're not really sure what the actual origin anniversary date is. So we do an anniversary show every year right around this time just to kind of mark it. I know that we've done over 900 shows. I've been supported by the station every year, amazingly, with great help. The very first show I did, the call-in show where we didn't know if it was going to work at all, my first two callers were Greg Perry, who's our development director, and Frank Lansone, who also I think was feeling worried for me. So they both called in that very first day. But since then, you know, we've done, as I said, over 900 shows on tons of topics and interviewed tons of really interesting guests. I've been supported by great engineers like you, Donna Cheek, who sits in. Thank you, Donna. But also, as I mentioned, Brian Lansone, Hank Hadley, so reluctantly is my reluctant engineer because he's always worried I'm going to make him talk. Just like Donna right now doesn't have her microphone on because she's so worried I'm going to make her talk. Jordan Bell was with me for a while, and then Tyler Pratt spent a few years with me, and Francisco Martinez, and now Brad Kyle. Time goes really fast, and here we are. It's been an interesting experience. And I think some of the highlights for me, besides being able to talk about these things that I care so much about, my hopes at the beginning, kind of the goal of the show was to give away everything that I knew as a clinician for free, because I felt so concerned that when people really needed help and they're in their moments of crisis, they're going to, you know, reach out to someone and kind of latch on to whatever the person has to say or whatever the treatment happens to be. And that's quite often how people get into trouble, because they hand over their agency to a professional, and this professional then can lead them in many different directions that can end up being devastating. And so I offered it. So I'm going to give away what I know for free. And I also want to help people understand or decide for themselves whether the helping professions as a whole are helping our collective mental health and well-being, or actually harming us in many ways. And how do we as consumers and people and human beings make mental health care services work for us and not just become a victim of or a statistic of this giant behemoth of a profession, which the mental health professions are. And so that was the beginning goals and hopes for the show. And also to be able to interview people who were finding creative ways to live their lives, to thrive, to find meaning for what they do. And quite often that's artists. And so a lot of interviews with Live Oak musicians and different musicians and poets and authors, and a lot of my heroes over the years that I've been able to talk to, like Daniel Quinn, who wrote Ishmael, one of my favorite interviews of all time. I got to fly to Houston and sit with him. And if you haven't read Ishmael by Daniel Quinn, it should be on your book list, because it's life-changing. Got to interview Kali Lawson, who is a founder of Adbusters, kind of a radical magazine. Just a lot of really fabulous experiences. Drove to Indiana with my husband to interview one of my other icons of my work and practice about parenting and young children, and how young girls kind of get lost in our system and end up kind of losing their spark at a really young age, and how to help them find that. So that's the story, Donna. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. We think we're starting our 18th year, give or take a month or so. You are welcome to be part of the conversation today. I'm opening the phone lines. I'd really like to know if you have any previous shows that you really enjoyed, topics over the years, or if there are any topics that I haven't covered or you haven't heard that you might find helpful. Our number is 805-781-3875. You can also find me after the show by sending me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. And you can podcast our show wherever it is you find your podcasts, through NPR Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, or find us on Spotify. And if you do find us, please leave a review so other people can find the show as well. And we are on Instagram and Facebook if you'd like to leave me a message there. Just always enjoy hearing from you. So 805-781-3875, a topic I haven't covered yet, a question you might have, or a favorite episode that you enjoyed. We're going to take a quick break and come back and take your calls right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
I hear you say life's taking you nowhere.
Angel,
come love, baby. Look at that sky, life's begun. Nights are warm and the days are young. Come love, baby.
This might be the last, that's all.
Opening doors and pulling some strings.
I'm Elizabeth Baird, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. Our number is 805-781-3875 as we kind of kick off our 18th year doing this show. When I started the show in 2008, as I mentioned, I was terribly concerned about the direction that our mental health care system was going, and it was really moving quickly towards medications and leaning heavily into medications, even at the cost of not using talk therapy at all. Managed care, the insurance companies really loved the idea that they could put someone on a medication and send them on their way and not have to pay for a lot of talk therapy treatments. And if they did include talk therapy, it was usually between 5 and 10 sessions. And those of us in the profession understood that in dealing with something as common as anxiety or depression, they're the two most common mental health concerns that people come to counseling for. It took a minimum of 20 sessions to help people kind of process their experience and then to learn new skills and then to put those new skills into action. And we weren't given the time to do that, but the meds were always heavily encouraged. And so at that time in 2008, 30.2 million adults in the U.S. were taking medications at the time. Sorry. Yes. And that ended up being 13.4% of the population. And that amount of people, I thought, well, that's not going to be any higher, because we know that when we look at mental health, really 1% of the population statistically can be suffering from severe mental illness. And that's like psychosis, schizophrenia, mental health emergencies that really are dependent on medication and would cause people to probably need in services, right? In community services and not outpatient services. But in 2008, we were already seeing and treating 13.4% of the population. Now in 2025, 23% of the population is in some form of therapy. We haven't improved our statistics. We've actually gone up. And there are arguments both ways. Like, well, now we have more access to therapy and therapy is not stigmatized and people feel more comfortable. And yes, that can be a good thing, but it also can be a negative thing if people are going into therapy and staying with it as if it's their life activity or their hobby or something they need just to get through. What we see in 2025 is that 48% of those in therapy are millennials, and 31% of those in therapy today are Gen Z. So that's 79% of those in therapy are the younger generations. 2 in 5 Gen Zs are in therapy now. and again, can be a positive thing, but also the challenges we see today are that so many young people believe that they need to have a therapist or be in therapy in order to get through their day-to-day forever, as opposed to what the original kind of cognitive behavioral therapy and the early therapies were about, helping people deal situationally with what was happening in their life, get the tools they needed, learn those coping skills, and then leave therapy. But now it's become almost like a lifestyle. And then the other thing that started the show that I was so concerned about was the amount of medications that were being prescribed. And at that time in 2008, 11% of Americans 12 and over were on some sort of SSRI or medication. And that at that time in 2008 was a 400% increase from 1988 to 2008. 400% increase in those medicated. And females were being medicated at the time 2.5 times more than men were. So my hope was starting the show that we would bring that number down, that we wouldn't continue to medicate people again when we saw that severe mental illness should only really be seen in about 1% of the population. Now in 2025, instead of going down, we have 16.5% of the American population on some form of medication. That's up 5% since I started the show. Gen Z alone accounts for 34% of the medications for mental health. We're not going in the right direction. And that's frustrating. And that's probably why I'm still here at the beginning of 18 years, because my hope was that we would start to give people enough information that they would find other ways to tend to their mental health and well-being and not be so quick to jump on to medications or be put into long-term mental health care or even feel like they needed actual intensive therapy. Because the vast majority of people, what they really need is a good counselor, good guidance, someone that can help them transition through a tough time, through a breakup, through a loss of a loved one, through the loss of a job. Those are normal occurrences that we move through in our life that we can use some help to get through. But today we look at therapy as kind of this deep introspection that can overwhelm someone's life and prevent them from really being able to engage day to day in their activities. Our number is 805-781-3875. This is a conversation with the Reluctant Therapist and Chris in Aurora Grande. How are you? Are you there? I'm giving it one more shot. Are you there? Okay, please call back. And how about Dave, are you there? I don't know why I'm not getting these calls coming through. Dave, are you there?
Yep. Hello, hello.
There you are. Thank you. Hi, thanks for calling in. What's on your mind today?
Well, I was wondering if you could maybe expand on or clarify if I understood in the introduction you were talking about how children, let's say, for example, with ADHD, were given meds, and then I think it was, you know, discovered or established that, I don't know if you used the term biologic, but it was had more to do with the environment in the home or the atmosphere in the home.
Mm-hmm.
I was just wondering if you could talk about, and I can take this off the air, just kind of sort of a typical parenting style or the atmosphere in the home that would trigger the ADHD.
Thank you. Thanks for the question. And I'm glad you asked, because it definitely requires some clarification. What I mentioned at the beginning was that when we look at children's behavior, one of the first things we should look at is the context of the behavior. What's happening in their home? You know, are their parents fighting? Is there instability? Are they getting enough sleep? Are they getting enough food? Children are like canaries in the coal mine. They're very sensitive and they react to their environment by acting out, whether it's getting very quiet and complacent, or sometimes they can be very aggressive. Children's responses to what's happening in their home or in their life around them can take a couple of different courses. And then when we see ADHD symptoms, attention symptoms, they can also show up for numerous reasons. One of the most common is lack of sleep, that children aren't getting enough sleep. Let's say the parents are working, you know, and from six, you know, dropping kids off from childcare at 7 a.m. and picking them up at 6 p.m. And by the time they get home and have dinner, kids aren't going to bed till 9, 10 o'clock at night. And then they're waking up at 6 a.m. That's not enough sleep. And we've seen that when children don't get enough sleep, that can cause symptoms of ADHD, attention issues in the classroom. The same with food. You know, if they're not getting enough meals consistently enough, they have low blood sugar, they can act out. Or if they live in chaotic homes that don't have a schedule and everything's kind of hit or miss, they're not quite sure what's going to happen, you can see those attention responses. So those are some of the things, Dave, that we see in homes that can result in seeing ADHD symptoms in classrooms. Well, also, does that help a little bit?
Oh, yes. That's very interesting, and thank you for clarifying. So in today's times, is that better understood, and they're weaning, for lack of a better term, children off of the prescription meds?
Well, I really wish I could say yes. In 2008, when I started the show, we had between 2.8 and 3.1 million children under 18, which was approximately 3.5% of the population, on some sort of ADHD medication. Boys, of course, were three times more likely to be medicated at that time. So my hope was that, yes, we would learn that behavioral interventions were really important, because, again, we want to get that number down to about 1%. We shouldn't be medicating that many children for any reason. But in 2025, we now have 42% of preschoolers diagnosed with ADHD. And
wow.
Yeah. That's just an incredible number, boys and girls. And there was a Stanford study that was done last year in 2025 where they found that overwhelmingly children, preschoolers who had been diagnosed with ADHD were being put on meds within 30 days of their diagnosis, bypassing what was recommended by clinicians and professionals, which is behavioral therapies, to see if that can manage the ADHD symptoms. But more parents were opting to go straight to medications than to take the time to do the behavioral therapies before taking on that prescription. So that's
interesting.
That's not heading in the right direction.
No, that's pretty sad. And then one more quick question. Talk to adults, hear adults that say, you know, I've got ADHD, and is that typically just a carryover from their childhood, or is there adults that have ADHD that might be, I guess, perhaps the same things you mentioned before, lack of sleep, diet, et cetera?
All of that is included, and I'm just going to say this piece. It's a diagnosis that's not taken by a blood test, right, or a sure diagnosis. There's long diagnoses for ADHD. They're very expensive. I think between $3,000 and $4,000 that are really extensive. But the vast majority of people are diagnosed with a checklist. And having said that, whether you have true ADHD or not, it's not necessarily a medicated issue. I'm experiencing this. Some people find relief with Adderall or some of the ADHD meds. Some people can manage without it. And that's really a personal choice, I think, for all people to understand what level, right, of care they want to take on. For ADHD, everyone has different temperaments. All people have different biologies. And that's what makes psychotherapy so challenging, is because the answer to every question is always, it depends. And it depends on, you know, are they getting enough sleep? Are they getting proper nutrition? Do they have a job that's chaotic and stressful that can be exacerbating the symptoms? You know, there's all of these pieces. And then ultimately, I want people to have the knowledge so that they can choose whether or not to medicate those symptoms. I think my greater concern is the medicating that we're doing for children who have not finished developing mentally or physically, and that we continue to discover that we have no idea how these medications have impacted the development of children. And I think that's where, for me, the bigger concern is. Adults who have completed their, you know, developmental stages after the age of 25 can take the information and make their choices for any kind of meds, SSRI or ADHD. But when you're talking about the amount of medicating we're doing for children, and I'm seeing it in my classrooms, I mean, the difference in my college class between my students today and 17 years ago is astonishing. How little ability they have to be resilient, their capacities to focus, their capacities to come to class regularly. And I think that's all a direct result of over-medicating and over the use of therapy on young children.
Well, that sounds right, and perhaps a mix of parenting skills also.
It's right. It's all part of that. It's all part of it, because nothing is just one answer. But I guess that the start of my show today was to say, I want people to have as much information as possible so that when they are making decisions for themselves and their children, it's from an educated place and not a place of panic. And also not a place of what they saw an influencer say on TikTok or Instagram, because to me, those Instagram and TikTok therapists or coaches are causing an intense amount of damage, because people are seeing these little brief blurbs on different conditions and self-diagnosing and walking in to an office and saying, this is what I have, treat me. And I don't think people realize how much mental health care relies on the individual and not on the person they're going to have fix them.
Mm-hmm.
I appreciate your call. Yeah, thanks, Dave. I appreciate it. Call again.
I really enjoy your show. Good luck and keep up the good work. Thank you.
Thanks so much. Have a great day. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. Our number is 805-781-3875. And we're, I guess, celebrating, Donna, if that's the right word, the beginning of my 18th year here at KCBX. And we're talking about maybe some of your favorite past shows, or what's a topic that I haven't covered or you haven't heard me cover that you'd like to hear. 805-781-3875. We're going to take a quick break, come back, and continue with our calls right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Y'all want to get into it? Keep your head up. Keep your eyes wide open. Brother, sister,
go ahead and get it.
Cause there's a party coming.
Ain't no need, come on.
Ain't no need to dress up.
Nah.
Just bring your best loving.
Sing. What you gonna do?
Come on and step up.
Uh oh. Yeah.
And keep your mind wide open.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. Our number is 805-781-3875. Chris, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
And I want to maybe move away from children's mental health for a minute, if you don't mind.
That's fine. What's on your mind today?
My favorite shows? The Daniel Quinn interview, fantastic. Really amazing. The guy is a rock star in alternative or realistic viewpoint.
Mm-hmm.
Joel Salatin from Polyface Farms.
Yes.
Really good.
I didn't really even know how great how Joel was before the interview, too. I was so surprised. It was such a great interview.
Yeah. And then changing our small world. People like Kara Woodruff, mm-hmm. Just recently, she's great. She's done so much for all of us. It's really good.
She was great.
And I like your interviews with the Live Oak artists and also Nick with Proxima Parada. The artist interviews are really fun. Really like hearing those.
Thank you. I'm so glad. Are there any topics that I haven't covered that you might find interesting?
You're going to ask me questions. Well, I don't know. You're great at finding, you know, viewpoints and subjects that that kind of open up my world. I guess the topic, maybe not a topic, but you must have a lot of friends and acquaintances in this community that don't seem to call in. You say, let's hear the call. And I just want to encourage everybody else who knows you and doesn't know you to pick up the phone, give a call, make it interesting.
Thank you. Well, I appreciate your encouragement, and I will try to continue getting those interviews on. Thanks for calling.
You're welcome.
This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. And our number is 805-781-3875. Favorite shows or topics you'd like to hear? Let's see. Is that Katrine?
Yes.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm so glad you called. What's on your mind?
I have 2 points. I'm over 60 years old, so we're sort of in the same age range here. Also a mom, and I've seen the over-medication and the starting of the ADHD over-medication when I worked in the school district.
Mm-hmm.
And what shocked me was the difference of seeing, and I don't like to use the word hyper because in my experience it just doesn't belong with children. I've seen very active children all of a sudden turn into zombies overnight because they were medicated.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody loved it. The school loved it. Their parents loved it. Nobody seemed to be concerned about that. So that's one thing. And, of course, then they continue to over-medicate them for the rest of their lives, et cetera, et cetera. And you raise the question as to why. Why is it this way? I think it's because that's where the money is. The money is in the drugs.
Mm.
It's not in therapy.
Mm-hmm.
It's not in community. The money is in over-medication. Because if you can make a phone call to whether it's a pain management specialist or whoever, psychologist, psychiatrist, and they can charge over $400 for less than 5 minutes of not even looking at you via Zoom, there's a problem.
Yeah. That I, Katrina, share some of your concerns because I hate in my heart to think that things all stem from money, and yet it seems over and over again the responses follow the money. When we ask, like, why are we doing the things that we do? Why do people get limited to the amount of sessions they get to have with a therapist through their insurance? You know, why is it that we choose one type of psychotherapy like CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, over equine therapy, which has an equal amount of positive outcomes as CBT? Why don't we offer those things? And again, it's always, like you said, follow the money.
Yep, there's no money in it. And it doesn't matter what you follow, whether it's the Epstein files or the whole fraud in terms of insurance and what they call health care in this country.
Yeah.
I grew up in Germany. It's very different in Europe. I'm not saying it's all golden there, but it is very different. And it's the money.
It's money.
It all leads back to the money.
It is.
And unless we change that as a society, and hopefully we will, with all the things that are coming out now, it's never going to change. It'll only get worse.
We just need people to keep talking, you know, speaking out as you did, calling in.
Yeah.
Do we just keep educating people and letting them know that there are alternatives to the types of therapies that are currently offered? Katrina, thank you for taking the time to call. I appreciate you.
Keep going. I love your show. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. You know, and the idea of following the money, again, feels really sad for me, but I see that with types of therapy that people are pursuing, that we seem to be very limited in what we think therapy is. And it's not just talk therapy, and it's not just telehealth over screen doing CBT, which is cognitive behavioral therapy. That's a great therapy. It works well. It's goal-oriented. It's short-term. It helps people work to modify their maladaptive behaviors and thoughts. It works by identifying and challenging negative irrational beliefs, giving people homework, helping them have actual steps they can take to manage depression and anxiety and PTSD and stress. It is very effective. CBT, though, is not long-term effective. It can be short-term fabulous to get people back and going, but long-term, real, deep second-degree change, second-order change for people comes in different kinds of therapies like EMDR or, as I mentioned, equine therapy or bibliotherapy, writing. There's a lot of really great, well-studied therapies that have nothing to do with medications or just plain talk. And I'd love to be able to talk more about those things as well. 805-781-3875 is our number. And is that Laura?
Yes. Good afternoon, Elizabeth. How are you?
I'm good. Nice. I really appreciate you calling in.
Well, I appreciate your show. And I wanted to tell you that I was most appreciative of you 2.5 years ago when I called in and you were doing a show on grief.
Yes.
I had just lost my youngest brother and love of my life, Patrick, and you were quite instrumental in helping me cope. during that very difficult time, and I want to thank you for that.
Oh, Laura, thank you. And I remember your phone call, so it's so good to hear
you
from
do.
You. Yes, I do. Yes, I do.
Okay, well, I appreciate that. Insofar as other topics, I think it'd be great if you revisited grief. There's a lot of us who grieve,
yes.
Not just me, but a lot of people, you know, whether it's a loss of a relative through death or maybe loss of love. We just passed Valentine's Day, and mm-hmm. sometimes that's kind of a downer holiday. So it'd be great to hear about loss and grief again. But on a brighter topic, you were talking about alternative therapies.
Mm-hmm.
I've been in therapy since the loss of my brother, CBT. And I want to give a shout out to Amber without saying her last name. She's been absolutely a godsend.
Wonderful.
And been long term. And I'm very grateful that my insurance continues to cover
yes.
her. Continue to see her 2+ years later. And exercise, I think mm-hmm. aerobic exercise and strength training are also very important aspects to helping with both physiological, psychological, biopsychosocial health.
Yes.
In general, being a personal trainer, I kind of have a prejudice in that direction. But I see so many women in particular, Elizabeth, women in their 60s, women in their 70s, women in their 80s, who thought they could never lift anything overhead. And they're knocking it out of the ballpark. And I see the changes in their self-confidence, their self-esteem, their self-efficacy. It'd be really great to focus on maybe a positive topic like exercise and anxiety reduction or exercise and depression or exercise and self-confidence. It's really, really a powerful mechanism, panacea, if you will, for all of the above I just mentioned.
So, I love it.
Anyway.
You know, absolutely. And that's actually right in kind of my purview, because I've been looking at a lot of, you know, the research about how do we maintain long-term mental wellness. And exercise is a piece of it. And I have kind of a mantra that I share with my students, because, you know, there is a big concern with orthorexia, which is over-exercising and over-clean eating and, you know, overdoing everything as more of a punishment. And so I have this in my slides almost every week. I say exercise should be a celebration of what your body can do and not a punishment for something you ate. And as soon as we can make that change, then our whole body responds differently. And Laura, thank you so much for being a listener and sharing yourself with me and the show. We appreciate you. 805-781-3875 is our number. And I want to piggyback with what Laura said, because when it comes to professional counseling, there are 4 factors that no matter what kind of therapy you go into are really important today. One is the therapeutic alliance. That is the relationship you create with your therapist. That's number one. Need to have that connection. The second is a therapist who understands empathic listening, that they're there to listen and respond and not give you advice and not tell you what to do and not tell you about their problems, but to really be able to mirror for you your concerns so that you can hear your own words coming back to you and work with them. And the third piece is collaboration, that you work together to come up with mutual goals, that it's not just the therapist telling you, here's what's wrong with you, here's your diagnosis. It needs to be a collaborative effort. And then the fourth is the most important and is often overlooked, and Laura touched on it, and that's the extra therapeutic factors. These are the key pieces that determine whether or not therapy will ever be successful. The first part is the life and environment of the client outside of therapy. What is their social support system? What is their own community involvement? What are they doing every day to be engaged? What are the stressful events that they're encountering? How does that impact them? Are you as a client doing your homework that your therapist is giving you? Do you know what it is you want to work on when you go into therapy? That's very important. You have to have your own personal goals. And then What is your ability to follow through and practice the new skills that the therapist is giving you? Because if you're just showing up week after week expecting something to be different, but you're not doing work outside of therapy, then it never changes. And then what is your willingness to change as a client? Will you do the things you need to do? Will you be able to withstand the pain of change in order to make your life different? And do you have the capacity to try new ways of thinking? Those pieces are much more impactful in whether or not therapy is successful than the therapist or even what type of therapy you do. And when they did a breakdown, the research shows that the relationship you have with your client is 30% of the success. The model or technique that's actually used is only 15% of success. The idea that things are going to change, the placebo effect, is another 15%. And then the extra therapeutic factors that I just mentioned are 40%. So 85% of the success in therapy comes from everything outside of the actual therapy technique you're using. And that's a really important thing to consider when you decide whether or not you're going to do therapy. You as the consumer, as the client, need to know what it is you're working for and have the capacity and ability to change. 805-781-3875 is our number. Katie, thanks for calling in. You're on the air.
Hey, congratulations on 18 years. How exciting.
Woohoo!
Just want to thank you so much for bringing all these great topics and getting us all to think. And I wanted to kind of give a shout out. I don't know if you've talked about it on your show, but some of the digital detox ideas that you have. And I liked what Laura said earlier about, you know, tying in exercise for mental health or creativity with mental health. And, you know, with kids, I just wanted to say for all the parents supporting everybody out there, when my kids were in first, second, third, fourth, fifth grade, the teachers were really encouraging us to keep the kids off the screens in the morning. They had seen a real difference with kids that were on devices or TV before school and their ability to have attention during school. And so we kind of made a pact with some of the moms that we would take the kids over and play for about 30 minutes and run around, have a good breakfast and get some exercise before they got to school so that they could be, you know, better able to sit around in class and learn. It was a real simple thing. And but they really did see since the early 2000s that devices or screens before school was really harming the kids' ability to pay attention in class. So I just wanted to share that because that helped me with my kids.
I love that. And also, there was a study around the same time that showed something as simple as getting the kids up and having them run around the field for 10 minutes between activities helped settle attention as well. It didn't have to be anything really complex, but just literally running them like puppies.
Exactly. That's what helped them every morning before class, because they're not quite getting enough of that playtime sometimes. And if kids have to get driven to school, then you got to get there a little early and run around. But anyway, thank you for your show.
Thank you for coming.
We can't wait to keep hearing more fun topics and the digital detox. Keep bringing that out for everybody. I hope people get out and get their pencils and write. Keep a journal next to their bed and write down, you know, become friends with themselves. I think developing the relationship with yourself can be the best relationship. And just getting a pencil and a paper is usually a good way to get in touch with that. So that's my thought.
100%. That's beautiful. Thank you. And I'm going to, thanks for calling, Katie.
Thanks. Bye.
On top of that, connecting with that, I can't wait to have the conversation about Jonathan Haidt's research. He wrote Anxious Generation. If you haven't read it yet, please do. But he has another book that's following up very quickly because so much actual research is coming in to support the idea that we shouldn't have children on social media at all under the age of 16. And we've seen in Australia, they've already banned social media in schools, and I think even having phones in schools. Like the dancing around this, well, it can be okay, or maybe we'll have parental controls, or maybe, you know, if the parents are paying attention. No, none of that works. The research is in. We're seeing Jonathan Haidt's talking about thousands of lawsuits that have been brought against these apps like Snapchat and TikTok and Instagram. Snapchat's already settled many cases with parents who have suffered loss, deaths of their children because of direct contact with these apps. So yes, Katie, you're right on board that our mental health concerns that I was dealing with in 2008 are being dwarfed by what's happening in 2025. And it's not that the world is challenging, but what's more challenging for young kids is their access to too much stimulation that they are not able to process and that is not ultimately helpful. But we'll do a whole show on that coming up soon. 805-781-3875 is our number. This is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. And John, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Hi, Elizabeth. Thank you. Can you hear me all right?
I hear you perfectly well. What's on your mind? Oh, then where did John go? Did you drop out real quick? John, can you give us a call back? Because I don't know why that we lost you for a second. So please give us a call back.
That's there. Can you hear me now?
Now I hear you. Carry on.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Somehow I got put on mute. I was acknowledging that I've been seeing a therapist for a couple of years, but an issue just came up that here I am at age 73, and my therapist suggested that I might have ADHD, and I said, oh, that's not possible. No. I've never thought for a second that I had attention deficit. But sure enough, he had me take a test, and when the test results came back, I'm off the charts, mm-hmm. he said. So I just thought I should let you know and your listeners know that this test was only about $300. It wasn't anything like $3,000.
That's good.
But I wanted to ask you, does that mean that maybe it wasn't a very effective test?
Well, John, here's the thing. Did it change your life at all, knowing this information?
Well, yes. I think back over a lot of places where I think my major problem is that I just have a difficult time reading the room. You mm-hmm. know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I will, and I can reflect back on several situations where, you know, I was interrupting people. I was talking over them. I was just concentrating on my own thoughts and not thinking about their input or not really listening. And, you know, that's a real problem, especially in my case. I don't know if you know this, but I was in politics for a while, and I even campaigned on the slogan, a leader who listens. Well, I didn't listen very well. So I think he's suggested a medication that I've been on for a few weeks now. I don't know if it's really working or not, but I expect, I'm actually meeting with him tomorrow and I'll find out. So I just thought I'd let you know that.
John, I so appreciate your honesty and you're willing to talk about it. And I'm just going to add two little side notes for it. Part of what you described is what being a man in our society is, where from a young age, men are given the room and told that they're the, right? So part of the listening challenge that men have is that they are taught very forever that that's their role, is to kind of own the room, to be leaders, to, you know, speak out. So that has nothing to do with ADHD. That has everything to do with social conditioning. And that can be relearned by practice. So I would encourage you to focus on those practicing skills first. And if the medication seems to be helping, again, you're a grown up and you get to make those choices. And I hope that they are helpful. But I want you to think about that gendered education you got and how that impacts your listening skills.
Yeah, sometimes I wish I'd been born female, but
that's another show. That's another show, John. Thank you so much for calling.
Thank you.
Have a good day. And Matt, thanks for waiting. You're on the air. What's on your mind?
Yeah, hi. I do very much appreciate your show. I certainly appreciate your advocacy for getting these kids off of these horrible medications, finding other ways to address the issues they have. One thing, I don't know if I just didn't hear it, but one thing that's very, very important for anybody of any age is what they're eating.
Yes, yes.
So that can certainly help even with people who've got dementia, et cetera, along with exercise and all that. So I really appreciate you being a voice out there. And yes, get those kids off social media, mm-hmm. 16. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, maybe even that's too young, but
I agree.
And I do have to bring up something that I've been meaning to contact for a while. There was over a year ago, and he did a show on, it seemed like it was encouraging young people to go into the military so that they could see the world. And I just found it kind of shocking in light of how many people have committed suicide coming back from the military. And I called in fortified by this. And then your answer was, and all the women are being raped in the military. And you go, oh, what about they're being raped in college? And I was just really taken aback. And I was so shocked that you had taken that stance. And I just have been meaning to call in.
I know.
Bring that up.
I wish you had brought it up earlier, because now I'm like at the end of my show here. And that's an important thing that I would love to talk more about, Matt. So, because now I'm trying to remember the show, and I can imagine that I talked about doing a year of service, not necessarily military, but I do a whole show around AmeriCorps and service years that are national service. But I don't remember ever doing a show that really leaned into military service. I would compare the two. So let me do some deep dive searches back to, you know, see what I was talking about. And because I completely understand the level of suicide and going into military and combat, like that would never really be my stance. So I'd have to look back and see what I was saying, because I feel like that was either out of context or I misspoke. So I appreciate you giving me a chance to readdress it.
Okay. Military, yes. Military, no. AmeriCorps, yes. And
yes.
Thank you. Thank you so much for so much.
Thanks for calling. And I appreciate it. I'm going to look back into that. And I got like 20 seconds for Sean. Sean, can you in 20 seconds give me a topic suggestion?
Absolutely. I think that you should do a show on psychopaths. I've suggested this before, but I think the first leader that really understood psychopaths, we should have had a national emergency. They should have said, okay, from now on, we're going to teach people that these are not axe murderers. These are politicians. Mm. These are, you know, television journalists. These are leaders in our community, CEOs. These people are as close to vampires as anything I've discovered in the real world. And I think if more people understood how they operate and what they are, maybe we could mitigate the damage that they do.
I appreciate that, Sean. And I'm going to have to do my own research, because I don't know if I am educated enough in the whole world of psychopaths to do a whole show, but we'll look into it. Thank you so much for spending this hour with me. This has been A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. You can send me topic ideas for shows to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. Find me on Instagram, Facebook. Please podcast the show. Share it with your friends so we can continue going for the next 18 years. Donna, thank you for being here. Thank you for tuning in, listening, and supporting Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
The heart is a blue. Shoots up through the stony ground, but there's no room, no space to rent in this town. You're out of luck, and the reason that you had to care, the traffic is stuck, and you're not moving anywhere. You thought you found a friend, take you out of this place, someone you can lend a hand in return for grace. It's a beautiful day. Sky falls, you feel like it's a beautiful day. To let it get away, on the road. But you got destination in the mud, in the maze of her imagination, your love is down. Even if that doesn't ring true, you've been all over, and it's been all over you. It's a beautiful day. We'll be right back.
tuna fleets clearing the sea out. See the bedwind fires at night. See the oil fields at first light. And see the bird with a leaving her mouth. After the flood, all the